welcome to Around and About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller, and on today's show, I'm speaking with one of the most familiar voices in public radio, Robert Siegel. For about 30 years, he's co-hosted NPR's All Things Considered, which airs here on WUTC every weekday from 4 to 8 p.m. Siegel has also been NPR's London Bureau Chief and Chief of NPR News, but soon he's going to be signing off. Earlier this year, he announced his retirement, effective January 5th, 2018. Siegel is approaching 70 years old, and he's said it wasn't an easy decision, that this has been the greatest job he could think of, but he feels it's time to begin a new phase of life. I'm really glad that we've got a chance to talk to Robert Siegel about his long career and what's next ahead of his retirement on January 5th. Robert Siegel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Mike, you're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
When you started at NPR in 1976 as a newscaster, what was it like back then? How vast was the NPR empire in 1976?
As empires go, it was a pretty minute empire. You could have fit the entire NPR news staff into a studio the size of the one that I'm sitting in right now, and it's not a gigantic studio. We had 10 reporters all told. We had one editor, and we had essentially one daily program. All things considered, which ran 90 minutes in those days, and then there was a couple of morning newscasts and a 9-minute morning show that I did 3 days a week. And it was full of young people. I wasn't yet 30, and I was pretty much median age for the place. It was a place in a beautiful facility, by the way. People, you know, we now have a marvelous building in Washington, but our studios back then were also really quite lovely, and I'd never seen such a good radio facility when I came to work here. And it was, while it was very small, it also clearly was supposed to get bigger. That is, the people were there not because this was the place that we wanted to work in this way at this level, but we wanted it to get bigger. We wanted it to turn into something more important, and it has.
Did Susan Stamberg used to really grade you when you were on the air in 76?
She did. When I did a newscast on All Things Considered, which wasn't my actual job, but they put me in there until the person they'd hired showed up. I was filling in. I was totally new, and we didn't have a newscast booth. You know, in most places, when the newscaster does it, it's in a different place from where the program hosts would be. But in this case, I would sit in the same room around the table with the two co-hosts, Susan Stamberg and Bob Edwards. At least two of us, Edwards and I, were smoking. I think Susan claimed to have quit smoking at that time. And I would sit there reading the newscast in their presence. One was a 5-minute newscast. The next hour, it was a 7-minute newscast. And Susan would be drawing with colored pencils to kind of pass the time during the program, and I guess to avoid smoking. And then I remember her at least a couple of times taking my copy at the end and writing something like A- on it at the end of the or maybe worse. I can't remember. And that was the atmosphere.
Did she help you? Did she help you improve?
No, she never gave me any constructive criticism. She just gave me a grade. That's all. It was, I think she wanted me to sound less nasal, and it probably took me 15 years to satisfy that criticism.
But, did the smoking help?
Did the smoking help? No. I won't say who, but I did have a colleague who claimed that stopping smoking would destroy the radio voice, and therefore you couldn't do it. I've never claimed that. I did eventually stop smoking, and I guess I started eating instead was the problem, but I gave up smoking, and I don't think that has harmed my voice.
You were head of NPR News for several years before being on All Things Considered.
4 years. 4 years, yeah.
Well, what exactly was that job? What were you doing on a day-to-day basis?
I was surviving is what I was doing. I had been put in this job after having been our man in London. I had really begun the NPR foreign system by being based at BBC and both reporting and recruiting freelancers and gathering BBC material for use on Morning Edition. And we had a terrible budget deficit, so I was brought back and was made head of news, which I did for 4 years. I chaired the morning departmental meeting. I was, in effect, the executive editor of the news organization. I hired and fired, or I proposed hiring and firing. Everything had to be signed off by a vice president above my grade. And I planned, and during that time, we took the station's very clear request for a sixth day of Morning Edition, hosted by the Monday through Friday host and reusing pieces, and subversively turned it into a mandate to create a Saturday morning show called Weekend Edition with Scott Simon, and took about a year to get that on the air, as I recall. And it was a great it was a very important moment for me, because it made people very optimistic about NPR, that we could launch this terrific new program, the only program I know of we launched that from day one sounded great to people throughout the system. And there had been a lot of pessimism about our future before that, so that was a big turnaround. Then I was involved in the launch of Weekend Edition Sunday, and of course I had to go to regional meetings with stations to hear what they had to say about us. And my other accomplishment during that time was getting a deal done whereby we distributed Terry Gross's program Fresh Air out of Philadelphia as a national program. So that's what I was doing.
You were talking about how in 83 you came in after a budget crisis, and certainly NPR and public broadcasting in general has faced different funding challenges over the decades. What kept you and everyone at NPR so optimistic over the years and made you think, you know, this is going to work?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, when I as I say, from 1979 to 83, I was based in London, where nearly all the people I ran into, except for some BBC folks, had no idea what NPR was. You know, they were Brits, and this was not as well known a thing as CBS or NBC or whatever. I then came back to America, and I was surprised to find how many people did know what we were, and how many people were listening to us, and how this new program we had launched, the Morning Edition, that had sent me off to London, had really raised our profile in the U.S. So I came back to a country where we were we had a significant audience, and it was perceived to be growing. And I remember realizing, it seems obvious in retrospect, that I didn't know by what device exactly NPR would survive or how it would raise enough money to keep going after this bad problem we've had. But it did make sense to me that we would likely succeed because there was a significant number of Americans who wanted us to succeed because they listened, and that listenership is ultimately the best guarantee of staying afloat. That if people want it by some means or other, we'll be able to keep going. And so it's not just flattering to know that a lot of people are listening, and it's not just the journalist's impulse that you'd want. It's more important that 10 people should hear my story than 2 people. It's also that's support for the institutional survival of public radio in general and of NPR in particular.
If you're just tuning in, that's Robert Siegel. The longtime co-host of NPR's All Things Considered is retiring in January. He's been with NPR for more than 40 years, reporting from around the world and around the nation. One particularly powerful piece that he created. On September 11th, 2001, he happened to be in New York, reporting for NPR, and after the attacks on the Twin Towers, he stayed there for days, describing what he saw.
Downtown, at Chambers Street, where Hudson Street and West Broadway form the point of a triangular vest pocket park, the sky is overcast with dust and ash. The air is so thick with it, it makes you cough. The emergency workers all wear masks. The sidewalk is coated with a dusting of this stuff, which is the pulverized remains of hundreds of offices. Offices that employed as many people as you would see in a major league ballpark during a pennant race. And in the dust, you find paper. Some newspapers, some magazines, but mostly artifacts that document what people did for a living in those offices.
A single page with three holes punched for a loose-leaf binder is a New York State tax form. The Chugoku Bank of Japan filed a surcharge return in 1998. Their offices were in One World Trade Center.
Another highlight of Robert Siegel's career at NPR, he and his colleagues won an Edward R. Murrow Award for this story about residents of Paris coping with the aftermath of the 2015 terrorist attacks in that city.
The crowds moved quietly, like museum-goers, as they observed the memorial bouquets and candles, or added to them with a hushed reverence. There are still bullet holes in the windows and walls, and the scenes of disorder inside were evidence of the chaos Friday night. Beer glasses still full on the bar, a single shoe on the floor, shards of glass.
Robert Siegel has also reported on subjects that he simply found interesting, such as smartphones.
I've got my smartphone open. I'm going to type out a message, capital H, and at the bottom of the screen are three choices. The middle one is hi, which is what I meant, hi.
On Monday, you did a story about predictive text on cell phones when you're typing and the phone knows what word you're going to want next. And you started that out by just saying this was something you personally were curious about. How much of a driver is that in your reporting, things that you're just wondering about?
I think it's a pretty important driver. I think that a lot of good story ideas spring from your real life experience of what's a real question you have and or in this case that I have. And I think that projects that attempt to answer such questions benefit from a genuine curiosity. And ultimately, there's somebody else out there who also is curious about this question. And years ago, I did a project on speech to text. I went and I watched one of these people who does closed captioning live on the fly in Pittsburgh, creating the closed captioning that you see on your television screens. And then we went to a software company that was, doing one of the biggest software programs for converting speech to text, dictating into text. And I was intrigued by what these things could get right, struck by how many things they still got wrong, and have been, curious ever since about how much better these various apps and software programs are getting.
You're not going to be hosting All Things Considered anymore, but does this mean you're completely leaving NPR?
I won't be doing anything else scheduled. Let's put it that way. Whether I come back on occasion, I don't know. But for now, I'm anticipating life unassigned, no deadlines, no stories, and that's quite fine.
Do you have any specific projects in mind right now?
No, my project is as I say, trying to remember what it was like to live without going to work every day.
Looking at your Twitter feed, your last tweet was from July 6th, and you said you don't tweet much. Is Twitter something where you really genuinely wanted to get on it, or was it more just people are saying, Robert, you've got to get on Twitter. Everybody else is.
The reason is, it was more than that. It's you better get on Twitter. All NPR hosts should be on Twitter and should be doing something. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't really wish to regularly tell people what I'm thinking or what I'm reading or seeing. And I just don't find it a personally compelling thing to use.
What about podcasts? Of course, NPR has just a ton of great ones. Are there any ones that you listen to in particular?
No. And it's just because I listen to the radio. I really don't listen to podcasts. And I listen to a lot of music. But, I told Terry Gross this the other day, that I recently read a book by a woman who wrote about the movie The Graduate, which came out 50 years ago, which I remember taking a girlfriend to 50 years ago. I was a senior in college, and this is about a recent college graduate, and everyone's always asking, Benjamin, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And he has no more an idea than I have an idea of what I'm doing after January 5th. So I feel like I'm reliving that experience. And when somebody finally gives him a tip and says, I have one word for you, plastics, as I told Terry, I've had the same experience, but the one word is podcasts. It's assumed that you know, the afterlife of the radio person is the podcast life, and I don't know. It's possible, but I'm a radio and music listener, and just really haven't gotten involved in listening to podcasting.
What about this younger generation of people who've come in, people who grew up listening to you on NPR and are now working there, getting their start? What are they like with radio specifically? Do they think it's still a medium that's going to keep going? Do you have those conversations with them?
I think we do. We have a bright young staff on All Things Considered, and there's another bright young staff on Morning Edition and on Weekend Edition, and I think that they know that when something goes on the radio, you get real feedback to it, so it's real. And I think that they are they're part of that. They've grown up differently. They have grown up listening to us and taking what we do seriously. I couldn't do that when I was growing up because there was no NPR to listen to. So I think one of the obstacles they face is thinking that the older people know what we're doing, because we don't. We've been improvising for decades, and that's worked pretty well. So I think it's important for young people to be encouraged to improvise a bit and to take ownership of this thing. They also, they're obviously they have not grown up. They have, let me put it this way: they have grown up regarding a clock radio as something their grandparents had. And I grew up thinking that that was how a radio station knew it could have you at the beginning of the day. And then if they could just hold you there, you were their listener. Today, we don't necessarily assume that everybody wakes up to a radio station that comes out of their clock radio, but maybe it comes out of their smartphone. I don't know.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Around It About Chattanooga. I'm Michael Edward Miller, and I'm speaking with Robert Siegel. The longtime co-host of NPR's All Things Considered is retiring in January. Ahead of his retirement, NPR has been replaying some of his favorite stories, like this one on Beethoven's Symphony No. 7.
The liner notes that accompany Simon Rattle's boxed set of the Beethoven symphonies speak of the heroic pathos of the Allegretto, and they mention that Franz Schubert was haunted by this movement for his whole working life. No kidding.
Is there anything that you haven't reported on that you really want to? Because you've been doing all these, or NPR has been replaying all these segments of yours over the years recently. Is there something that you still, a burning question you still want to answer?
I could fish for something and say that, but the truth is no. I really don't have a great bucket list of things I haven't been able to do. I've had a wonderfully rewarding run of over 30 years, over 31 years as host of All Things Considered, and I will leave that feeling pretty darn satisfied with the opportunities I've had to satisfy my curiosity. I hope it's felt good to the people on the other end of the radio.
It certainly has. Robert Siegel, thank you so much. We're all going to really miss hearing your voice every day.
Mike, thank you very much for that. And thanks to everyone for listening and for supporting you guys. And by doing so indirectly, supporting us at NPR.
Thank you. That was Robert Siegel, the longtime co-host of NPR's All Things Considered, is signing off on January 5th. That's it for Around It About. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. Thank you all for listening.
Around and About Chattanooga is a production of WUTC with contributions by the staff and volunteers of WUTC. Find us online at wutc.org.